from KYW News Radio 103.9 FM. This is Bridging Philly, connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you. Presented by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org.
Hello, I'm Raquel Williams. Welcome to Bridging Philly. Books Through Bars is an organization that has been sending free books to incarcerated people in six mid-Atlantic states since 1987. Their mission is important because 75% of people who are incarcerated did not complete high school, and years behind bars deprives people of a formal education, job experience, and financial earnings. I sit with three of the volunteers from Books Through Bars to talk about their work.
We have received letters from many people saying, I got my GED because of the books you sent us.
And Charity Howard visits the Wick House Rose Garden.
We have plants whose rootstock are over 200 years old in our garden.
All that's coming up on Bridging Philly. Across the United States, many incarcerated individuals are deprived of access to books. In many facilities, prison libraries are underfunded, heavily restricted, or even non-existent. Mail policies also limit what can be sent, and yet the need for knowledge, escape, and hope exists. Books become more than reading material. They become lifelines, tools for survival, and sometimes the only connection to a world beyond the cell. For over 35 years, Philadelphia-based Books Through Bars has stepped into that gap, sending free books and educational resources to people in prisons across the country. Their work raises essential questions about literacy and incarceration. Joining me for a discussion are three volunteers from Books Through Bars, Sparrow, Stephanie, and Mark. Welcome to Bridging Philly.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
All right, so let's first talk about what inspired the creation of Books Through Bars 35 years ago.
As the oldest volunteer, we came out of the New Society Publications. There was a publishing house located in West Philadelphia at the time, and someone working for that publisher and said, do you have any damaged or, we call them remaindered books? And the person started sending them out just sort of as a side project, and it grew, kind of word got out, and ended up growing past the, beyond the walls of just a random project and became its own nonprofit. And we were established in 1990 as a 501c3.
And now, when that all started, was there any pushback to getting this thing off the ground, or was there full support?
I mean, I think there was full support because we had really strong founders at the time. Some people felt very passionately. Actually, she's Barbara Hershowitz, I believe it's how to pronounce her name. She is on the side of our building on a mural. She was sort of it was a passion project for her. So I think there was a lot of support in the community and donors. But we all, to be honest, were not around at that time.
No, I understand. Yeah. I understand that. Okay. So that walk us through how it all works, how you books get to the different people that are in different institutions. How does that happen?
So it all starts with a letter. Somebody mails us a letter, and they will give us their name, their information, and what books they want. It can be as general as, I don't know, anything, and specific as, I want a book about this very particular reptile because I want to learn about it. Once we get that letter, we have somebody read it and log it. We have a computer database system called Prebo that helps us track all requests. In Prebo, we store things like institutional restrictions and when has this person requested us last. We store their name. We store their inmate number. And through there, Prebo prints us a label that we stick on the envelope. That labeled envelope goes to somebody who goes into our library, picks 3 to 5 books that hopefully match what they want. It's a library of donated books, so it's very luck of the draw kind of deal. But once the books are picked, we have somebody double check them for quality. We write an invoice for them so they know what they're getting. They also get stamped with our address inside so that A, they know it came from us, and B, is a little advertisement because those books will circulate inside the prison. So if somebody opens a book their friend gave them and goes, hey, wait a minute, this is an address I can write to get books.
Oh, okay.
So that's been really helpful to kind of help us get more traction. Once the books are invoiced, there's 2 diverging paths. One is getting wrapped in brown paper and shipped to the institution itself. The other is being put in a bulk box with others for the state system. Both Pennsylvania and Virginia do this. And then it gets sent to a processing center where the prison will screen it, mostly proprietary methods. They don't tell us how. And then the person gets their books.
Okay. Are there challenges, though, when it comes to the kind of books that some people may request? Are there restrictions in prisons for that?
Lots of prisons have differing restrictions. And so we need to understand like what each institution's restrictions are and then stay up to date as they change. And so sometimes we'll receive packages back. They'll say like, oh, we can't accept hardcover anymore, or oh, we can't accept this specific book.
Can you give me some examples of some, I guess, subject matters that are most prisons or institutions will not allow in there, in your experience?
Nudity.
I mean, yeah, okay. Anything with nudity, yeah. Of course. And of course, no, like, lockpicking 101. You know? there's certain obvious things that everyone blocks, but we've seen a lot of restrictions with subject matter mostly coming from other states due to the fact that Pennsylvania does not mail us back things that they're rejecting based on content. We don't, it's sort of a black hole there. Hmm. So if they are not passing on a book, we generally don't hear about it. But fortunately, I don't think that happens very often because we get a ton of thank you letters and repeat requesters from Pennsylvania. About 80% of what we serve is our state incarcerated individuals, and they write us constantly, and we have not heard reports of issues. So we feel fairly confident Pennsylvania is letting things through at a relative level. But for some other institutions, we've had like the Bluest Eye be rejected, or an insane list from Virginia. Sometimes the Art of War.
Electrical books. Mm-hmm. So like if you want to learn how to be an electrician or kind of DIY style. The concern is that they will use that knowledge to destroy things in the prison rather than create. So it's more of a blanket ban than this specific page contains instructions on how to start an electrical fire, which those books don't have.
Right. Sometimes some federal institutions also block computer books, which I feel is too blanket of a block. They're worried they're going to learn how to hack things and from a security perspective are concerned. But typically people are looking to improve their opportunities when they are released and they just want to learn job skills. How often have we all heard, oh, you should just learn to code? And they are following that mantra and trying to teach themselves, and we're not allowed to send them computer books in certain institutions.
One restriction that I see a lot that's very frustrating is that we're not allowed to send in blank paper, like journals, notebooks, that kind of thing.
For them to write in.
Correct.
Why?
And we believe that that's because they're selling like blank paper journals, that kind of thing, in their commissary. And so that would cut into their profits.
Interesting. Yeah,
you're not allowed to mail in blank greeting cards as well. We actually try to send in books as much as we can about how to make greeting cards. I think people have like a little bit of a side business that they can make a really pretty greeting card for someone or for their family because they're so expensive.
So interesting. I had no idea there were so many restrictions. Interesting. Mm-hmm. But how many books would you say you have distributed thus far, or maybe per year?
So 10,000 requests a year.
Wow.
3 to 5 books per request.
Wow.
So that's anywhere from 30,000 to 50,000 books.
That is tremendous, I have to say. Yeah. So the donations, talk about how people donate books, the different ways that you're able to curate different books. How does that work?
We do a lot of fundraising every year. So we also have cash and we buy some books. For example, dictionaries, we may buy 300 or 400 law dictionaries and reference materials that are more asked for than donated. But most of our donations do come from like a lot of the community. People hear about us, they Google us, where can I donate books? We have a lot of information on our website about what we would prefer to receive. You can imagine the typical volunteer nonprofit issue where you have a lot of volunteers of a certain demographic or interest that doesn't necessarily match up with really the public that we're serving, which is, I would say, if anyone's looking, check our website. And also think about what we send in as what would you see on the shelves of a public library is what you'll see on our shelves typically.
Okay. So talk a little bit about why access to books and educational material is so important for those who are incarcerated.
A lot of times being in prison is very emotionally damaging and very, very isolating, especially when somebody is placed into the restricted housing unit, also known as solitary. Solitary confinement is very mentally damaging, and books can help counteract that damage by giving them something to do. We also get replies from people that say, this book helped me escape mentally. I was able to go into a fantasy world and run around with the dragons and the knights and not be here where I am. So that's very helpful. You know, we have a very strong mantra that there's no such thing as a junk food book. they're all good.
Right.
From, you know, graphic novels all the way up to classic literature. They all help somebody build their literacy skills, and they all help counteract the emotional isolation. There's, of course, books that we send in dictionaries. Dictionaries are very highly requested so that people can build their literacy skills. Mm-hmm. They can get better at reading. They can learn more words. A lot of people end up in prison after a childhood where they don't get access to good schooling. They don't have special education to help them. They don't have parents and adults in their lives who support them through their education. So being able to send them books for them to go back and start working on that education, you know, GED books or commercial driver's license books, mm-hmm. so they can start looking for a career after they're released.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly, connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you.
I am kind of familiar with some of these programs. There's one in New Jersey I was able to visit, and just hearing from some of the incarcerated individuals say, this is a lifeline, like you were saying. This is literally a lifeline for me, my only escape. And a lot of them are just, you know, either trying to pass the time or, even like you were saying, to better themselves, prepare themselves for, you know, a better life outside when they are granted their freedom. So if you can talk about how programs like this kind of reduce the recidivism rate, is that something that's true?
I mean, literacy in general, like once people emerge from prison and they have like a GED, they've learned how to read, like that's documented very strongly about. And the issue we've seen with lots of prisons is the education opportunities have been cut. When you cut funding, you cut the nice things, right? You may have a library, but you save money because the librarian leaves and you don't hire someone. You know, the first thing that gets cut is the niceties. And so this should not be viewed as a nicety.
Having a GED sets somebody up for success. We have received letters from many people saying, I got my GED because of the books you sent me. Mm-hmm. They send us a transcript of their GED passes, which is very special.
Yes.
You know, we also received a letter from somebody who had been in solitary for 25 years, and he said that he had been illiterate when he started that, but because we sent him books for years, he taught himself how to read and wrote us a nice card and told us that he had written a book.
Wow, that's tremendous.
Yeah, that is one person, but that's the kind of impact mm-hmm. prison literacy programs and prison book programs have.
I mean, I can see how this definitely impacts mental health. Being in solitary confinement for 25 years, I didn't even know that was allowed.
It is.
Mm-hmm. I'd actually love to read the book that person wrote. I can only imagine, you know, the words that were able to form on the pages after that experience. That's really something else. I didn't ask you all, though, and I'm curious to know how you all got involved with Books Through Bars and why are you so passionate about this work?
I got started about a year and a half ago. I had just graduated college, was looking for things in the community to get involved with, and found Books Through Bars. And I just found it really easy to come and volunteer. We have regular volunteer sessions. I started coming back and I made some friends. I really enjoyed the work. But what really kept me coming back was at the time we were working on a survey project, and we had sent surveys out to some of our top requesters, people who had requested 10 or more times over the period of several years, because we only allow requests once every 3 months, just so that we can fulfill as many different people's requests as we can. Mm-hmm. And just the outpouring of gratitude and the stories that I read while I was supporting, like transcribing all of these surveys, really deeply touched me. And there were a couple of stories that were really meaningful to me and helped me have some perspective on my own life.
Wow.
There was one person in particular that his story will always stick with me, where he was experiencing chronic pain. And the pain management medication that the doctors were giving him just weren't even touching it. I've also like experienced chronic pain in my life, and it's a terrible experience, feels inescapable. And he said that he used books as a way to escape that and kind of distract himself. And it was the only thing that was able to help him. And that meant so much to me, seeing that we were able to provide that kind of mental escape from something that's really terrible. And like similarly, other folks said that they had cancer, and fighting cancer is really hard, but it's especially hard in prison. But it was difficult to get down from the health ward to go to the post office, or what's it called?
The mail room
to pick up anything. But they always made a point to get down and pick up their books. And it felt like Christmas. And it was something that they could look forward to. And like being able to provide those moments of joy and connection and just access to resources meant so much to me.
Wow. Love that. Love that story. And the stories like that, that can, I guess, continues to drive you to do the work that you're doing. So Absolutely. It must be very rewarding.
Yeah.
What about yourself?
Yeah. I think it was a little different. I used to be a librarian, and I was charged with organizing a book drive for Books Through Bars at my previous employer. And I was dropping the books off and was just struck by the bustle and energy of the community. And I thought, oh, wow, this is something that I would love to get involved with. People are so excited to get books into the hands of people who want them. So I started volunteering at that point. And I think, you know, Sparrow lights on a lot of great stories that we encounter. Reading the letters and hearing from our constituents like really keeps people coming back. It's incredibly rewarding. Like, yes, I feel very selfish saying, like, I just love reading and hearing from people, their stories. But, you know, I think, especially when you look at the wider world around us, we feel like we can't make an impact. And what you can see every day when we, you know, provide the service that we do is that it's real harm reduction. You know, we're reaching that individual in a meaningful way to them. You know, you have people send you their certificate and you feel like, wow, we really maybe helped that person. Yeah. And that's great. So that keeps me coming back.
Yeah. Mark?
So I had done some previous work around the prison system. I worked with the Philadelphia Bail Fund. That project kind of came to an end, and I was looking for something new. And I loved reading as a child. I also used books to escape. So, you know, here is this place where everybody loves reading. It's full of books. And I walked by the organization during Dollar Stroll, which is an event in West Philly that we participate in. And from there, I was just hooked. It's right near my house. It's convenient. I love books. I love reading. I love being able to try and make an impact in the wider decarceral movement. So
I think it's wonderful that you're serving this often forgotten about demographic. It seems as though, you know, just because people are incarcerated, it's not like, you know, lock them away, throw away the key, don't think about them anymore. There are different reasons why people are in prisons and in incarcerated. And many of them do want to come out and be productive members of society and go on with their lives and have that second chance. And it's just great that escaping into a book or furthering their knowledge with a book can help them do that. Talk to me about who writes you. What are some of the patterns? Do you notice that it's younger people, people that are older? What's the demographic of people that you normally see that are writing you in for books?
I mean, I think it really runs the gamut. When we're looking people up to see where they're located, we can often see their date of birth. And often we see people that are, I'm not going to tell my age, but, you know, maybe 10 years younger than me. And I realize how much that they had ahead of them. And now that's going to be very different than maybe what they imagined. So it's a little heartbreaking. And then on the other end, we have people who, if they were on the outside, they would be retired. And they're sometimes at that point have been incarcerated perhaps for a long time and they feel a little forgotten. And I think that I always like to serve those people as well.
Yeah. In terms of raw demographics, our requester base is mostly Black and Hispanic, mostly male, because that is who incarceration affects most disproportionately. We don't have a lot of women requesters. We do have a very small, dedicated transgender group of requesters, and we love seeing letters from them.
Are there areas or regions that you currently don't serve that you wish you could? Can you talk a little bit about the areas that you serve?
We serve the Mid-Atlantic region, so Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. Okay. And then sometimes we'll make a little exception for D.C. because they're in between Maryland and Virginia. But we used to be actually nationwide. So we were established in the late 80s and then formally in 1990, I believe. And then we actually served the entire country. And then as mass incarceration rose, we had to actually draw back. So I would say sometimes I look at the number of states we serve and I feel good about it, but I also feel like there's always that gap that we no longer serve the nation because we can't possibly have the resources for it. There are other prison book programs we collaborate a little bit with and they do, but I would say in terms of regions that we don't serve, that that probably hits the hardest for me.
Also, just to speak to that a little bit as well, we're part of a very loosely connected network of other Books to Prisoners groups, where like we meet on a monthly basis, we share knowledge and resources and tell each other like what are the things that are happening locally. For example, there was just a book restriction implemented in Texas that is effectively a ban. Similar things happening in other states like New Jersey. And so while we aren't able to serve requests in every state, if we receive a request that we cannot serve, we'll pass it along so that it can be fulfilled.
What would you say is your long-term goal for Books Through Bars? What are some of the things that you'd like to see over the next, say, 10 years or so?
Well, I have a joke. I'd love to see us go out of business.
Ah, of course.
The dream of every nonprofit.
Yeah.
I think I would like to see us shorten our request to shipping time. I mean, we're a volunteer organization, yeah. So it can take a couple months. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see that shortened. Like, obviously, we're not going to compete with, like, a bookstore mm-hmm. who has employees and stuff. But, you know, a little quicker would be great.
We're our own worst enemy here. People always remind me when we shorten the time, we end up getting just more letters because people write us and say, oh, they're sending books out pretty quick. Let's get their, you know, request in. And yeah. So we catch up and then immediately get more letters that are then slow us down, which is, you know, it's hard. It's an uphill battle.
Yeah. And I will also add to that, it's that we have gotten feedback that we're one of the quickest Books to Prisoners organizations that responds to requests. Mm-hmm. But there's always room for improvement. I would also say just generally, like how I see our North Star is education, both inside and out. And so our mission is twofold. We want to provide access to resources and books for people on the inside, mm-hmm. but also educate people on the outside. Yeah. Just by virtue of the work that we're doing, people are exposed to what are the realities for people that are inside prisons. Yeah. Additionally, like with the survey, for example, we learn a lot of information about like how these books are having an impact and what are some of the concerns that are on people's minds and how are we feeling that and what can't we do? And how can we work with other organizations that are like-minded in the area to better serve people who are in prison? And so I would just like to see us continue to like educate the public. And so recently in the last couple of years, we've started participating in something called Prison Banned Books Week, where we do a fundraiser and we usually do an educational event where right after Banned Books Week is Prison Banned Books Week.
Okay.
And we share a little bit about like what is the state of book bans in prison.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so there's lots more to educate people on because a lot of people just don't know what it's like inside prisons.
Right. Absolutely. That's very true. As far as volunteers, I'm not sure how big your staff is, how many volunteers you do have, but I'm sure that you're always looking for more, correct?
Always.
All right. How can people get involved and volunteer? And who are you looking for to volunteer?
A lot of different people, honestly. Mm-hmm. We have varied kinds of work. We have, you know, sitting down and writing, walking around and book shopping, you know, people who get books for us and drop them off, people who give money. We spend a lot of money on postage. If you want to get involved in volunteering, you can go onto our website. You can bring a group of people, like 15, and we'll do a private session with you. And if you want to drop in, you can come to one of our new volunteer orientations. There's a sign-up form on our website. You can come to a new volunteer orientation, and then from there, you can come when you can.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In terms of types of volunteers, I wanted to add, we do end up attracting a lot of like former librarians or current librarians, but I think what's really great is our mix of volunteers. We have a ton of people from all walks of life, from 18 on up, mm-hmm. and we have people who are formerly incarcerated that come and volunteer and help out as well, sometimes in part of like a formal community service. And then sometimes they want to come back and give back because they received our services in the past. And so I think a really great mix has always been super successful. So I would just really encourage everyone to, you know, if you want to be a volunteer because we welcome everybody.
Okay. And what is the website for people to go to?
Booksthroughbars.org.
Easy enough. Booksthroughbars.org. Okay, well, Sparrow, Stephanie, and Mark, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing how this program works. We do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly from KYW News Radio 103.9 FM.
Welcome back to Bridging Philly.
The Wick House has served as an ancestral home to one of Philadelphia's most impactful families for 9 generations. The house is also home to one of the nation's oldest original rose gardens. On this week's Shara in the City, Shara Day Howard is in Germantown exploring the Wick House and the garden.
This week on Shara in the City, we're in historic Germantown at the Wick House, a landmark house with a magical garden and community farm. Now, it was an ancestral home of a local Philly family from 1690 all the way up to 1973. And today, we're getting a peek inside. And of course, we got to walk through their award-winning Rose Garden. So we're meeting up with my friend Kathy. You know, she pulled a few strings to get us a one-on-one. Now, I can smell the garden from here. It's amazing. This is a moment for Scratch and Sniff Radio. Let's go.
Hey, how are you today?
How you doing, Kathy?
Wonderful. Glad you stopped by Wick House.
So am I. It's gorgeous.
It is. Everything's in bloom, you know. So the person you really want to speak to today, even though I'm the board chair for Wick House, is Kim Staub. She's the executive director. She just took us through this whole restoration. Kim, hey.
How you doing? Nice to meet you today.
There's always something else to know, to learn, as long as you're curious.
Yes, and that's our tagline is feeding curious souls. So there's something here at Wick for everyone.
How old is this home? Let's get a little history first.
Sure. So the family lived here starting in 1690. The first house would have been a little log cabin that doesn't exist anymore, but the house that we're standing in today, some of it was built in 1736, some of it was added in the 1770s, it started to be combined in the 1790s, and then finally finished in 1824. So we kind of think of it as a Frankenhouse. There's little bits added as we go.
And especially since we're all celebrating the 250th, kind of special.
Yeah, the family, they were entrepreneurs, they were brewers, they were linen weavers, they were educators, they were philanthropists, so involved in so many of the founding institutions that made Philadelphia the capital of the United States.
This family, wow, what a contribution.
If there was an early movement, the family probably had their hands in it somehow.
Now, this house also claimed to fame, the Rose Garden. Let's talk about that.
Yes, we are the oldest rose garden in its original plan in the United States, which is a lot of qualifiers to just say it was planted in 1821 by the 6th-generation resident Jane Haynes the first, and it has remained there ever since in the same form. We have plants whose rootstock are over 200 years old in our garden.
I love it. What can we see today?
Awesome. We'll first start here in the conservatory. We have this really gorgeous genealogy of Wick that was hand embroidered actually by a family member, Laura Haynes Bellman. It was a labor of love that took her 10 years to stitch. And it outlines those 9 generations that called Wick home from one family, starting in the 1690s with Hans Meilen and ending with Robert Bowne Haynes and Mary Troth Haynes in the 1970s. The family didn't leave until 1973. They left behind over 10,000 objects and 100,000 manuscripts. So we still have all the objects here at Wick. The papers are now at the American Philosophical Society, where they're accessible to researchers who use it to study everything from the yellow fever epidemic to early American scientific endeavors and even things like our heritage roses.
All right, let's hit it.
All right.
What's next?
In 1824, the conservatory is that space between the two houses. So right now we're in the 1730s portion, and the house was combined by William Strickland, who's famous for the Second Bank of the United States. And he did this house for his friends Reuben and Jane. But one of the really cool things he did was actually install these folding four-way doors, and it's just a way to create flexible floor plans throughout the house, because it is a long, large house.
Yeah, and these doors are huge, and this thoroughway is pretty wide.
Yes.
Like a horse could fit through.
They can actually close all 4 directions. Oh, so it creates
wow.
a flexible floor plan for the family if they wanted to keep the kids in a room because they were being noisy, or if they wanted to keep the heat in. If they wanted to hide the staircase, they could do it.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like it. And then there's a tiny restroom.
We lovingly refer to it as our Harry Potter bathroom under the stairs.
Yeah, you could just disappear in there.
The thing I love about Wick is there are these layers of history. Yes, we're in a 1730s house, but we have objects that go up until, you know, the family left in 1973. So you can just see these layers of history. Yeah. All of the objects you see in the house, minus the modern dehumidifier and a few of the rugs.
Wow, they were ahead of their time. Frigidaire.
They are all family objects. So we don't have to go to auction and buy more collections. We have all the family stuff. And we know from different receipts that these chairs have been in this room for 200 years. It's pretty incredible.
It really is.
One of our famous objects is our blue chair that's over there in the corner. And that was originally owned by Benjamin Franklin. So Reuben, who's up there on the wall, he bought that from Franklin's estate. And then to make the chair even more famous, in 1825, the Marquis de Lafayette came to visit Wick, met with Reuben and his family, and he was given Benjamin Franklin's chair as the seat of honor. Two famous butts, for sure, have sat in that chair, along with a lot of family members. But we have a lot of really cool objects at WIC that don't survive anywhere else. So we get the dolls, we get the sort of broken toys. Imagine never cleaning out your attic for 9 generations.
It's up in the attic. All right, so this toy looks really cool, but also looks as old as it probably is. It's a horse with two wheels. It looks like a carriage. Amazing, what is that?
It's a velocipede. So it's the opposite of a tricycle. It's you pedal with your arms and you steer with your feet versus the tricycle where you pedal with your feet and steer with your arms. And that's the kind of magic you find at WIC, is these objects and papers and letters telling a full story.
The provenance.
Doesn't happen a whole lot of other places.
Never. All right, so where next?
Let's go into the back parlor.
All right. It's cool, kind of creepy, because you can almost feel the spirit of the family here in like a really positive way. Very welcoming.
Thank you. We put a lot of effort into it. The family were Quakers. They wanted everything to be welcoming. And so there's stories for everyone. If you're into science, we've got it. If you like dolls and want to see the creepy closet full of dolls, we got that.
You know there's a creepy closet full of dolls. Okay, between you and me, spirits, have there been sightings?
No.
How's it possible?
It's a very peaceful place.
I'm gagged.
Warm family vibes. We are in the back parlor now where we have a lot of scientific objects. So the sixth generation Reuben, he was one of the founders of the Franklin Institute, the Academy of Natural Sciences, the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, all these famous Philadelphia institutions this family had their fingers in.
How did this rose garden come about?
Sure. We actually have letters from Jane lamenting that she didn't have a formal garden to share when visitors came to see her here in Germantown.
So let's go see it. Yes. And then tell me.
Jane, she made a little garden plan. When we say that these are 200 years old roses, we do have them.
It's gorgeous. I mean, there's a path of stone, and on either side and directly in front of you, just roses everywhere.
Roses everywhere.
Rose world.
And they only bloom for a really short period in May. So we're actually at the tail end of the bloom right now. If you miss them, come back next year. So we have a few very special roses here. They thought that they were actually extinct before they were rediscovered here at WIC in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
So we have a Lafayette rose, which is in this front parterre, named, of course, after the Marquis de Lafayette.
Oh, wow.
And then the elegant Gallica rose in the second parterre they thought was extinct. If you see them anywhere in the world, they all come from cuttings here at WIC, which is really amazing.
Really? What is it, like a lavender, kind of like a rouge?
A lot of different shades of pinks. Yeah. So we're looking right now at this Baltimore Belle, which is one of the few native roses that we have here in our collection. And it's this really pale shade of pink. But if you look at Lafayette's, they're a real almost purplish, deep, deep pink.
Yeah.
And we also have some cool experiments with some of the early attempts at making yellow roses, some creams and peaches. I know that we can tell about 300 years of rose breeding history with our collection here. It's stunning when it's in full bloom. You can smell it a block away.
That's how I got here today.
Yes.
And not too long ago, it was all over the news. A vandal came through and did some real damage.
The vandal really damaged our Towsonchun rose, which is one of the oldest ones on the front of the house, planted here in 1911.
And this is the one we're looking at.
We're looking at it, and it's past its first bloom. It will rebloom later this year, but the good news is that it's recovering, and it will carry the scars of the vandalism for a while yet. It's a slow growing rose, but it survived, and it's a great metaphor for WIC. You know, despite all of it, we get through it, we survive, we're long lasting.
Good news, folks.
The family, when they created the WIC Association, their goal was to bring people in who maybe wouldn't have access to green space and resources. So we do as many of our programs for free as we can. Farm Club is free. Our general house tours are free. So our next big festival is Honey Festival in September.
If they have any questions, they want to come.
You can reach out to us. info@wyck.org is the best way to reach out. We're trying to take the hidden out of the hidden gem. We just want to be a gem for our community here in Germantown.
I love it so much. Thanks for sharing today.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming. It was great to visit. Bye, Cheryl.
Bye, Cheryl. Thanks for coming.
Yay!
Thank you for joining us. Bridging Philly is brought to you by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org. For more information on Bridging Philly, follow KYW News Radio on social media. And if you have any ideas for interesting features that you'd like to share, feel free to get in touch with us at bridgingphilly@kywnewsradio.com. For Sharaday Howard and our producer Sabrina Boyd-Circa, I'm Raquel Williams. Be well.